Chapter 7 Raising Hell. And surely there is in all children a stubbornness and stoutness of mind arising from natural pride, which must, in the first place, be broken and beaten down, that so the foundation of their education being laid in humility and tractableness, other virtues may, in their time, be built thereon. John Robinson, pastor of the Pilgrim Colony. If modern children are being denied the oxygen of experience, it may be because well-intentioned parents have been led to believe that the world is too dangerous a place for unsupervised play. We wipe our little miracles with antibacterial solutions, lead them around on protective leashes, encase their heads in helmets, and isolate them from strangers. But as is so often the case, while we're busily defending against largely imaginary dangers, we're creating real problems. Despite all the media reports of abducted, murdered innocents, kids face less danger today than when you and I were catching frogs in the woods or playing under the street lamps. The overall child mortality rate in the United States has never been lower than it is right now. In 1935, there were roughly 450 deaths for every 100,000 American kids between 1 and 4 years old. Today, that number rarely reaches 30. Mortality rates are down by almost half since 1990, and for a kid between 5 and 14 years old, the chances of premature death are around 1 in 10,000, or 0.01%, according to reporting by Christopher Ingram in the Washington Post, who concludes, "Kids are dying less, they're being killed less, they're getting hit by cars less, and they're going missing less frequently too. The likelihood of any of these scenarios is both historically low and infinitesimally small. Bottom line, if it was safe enough for you to play unsupervised outside when you were a kid, it's even safer for your own children to do so today." While some of these reductions in risk to kids are probably due to increased parental vigilance, there's little doubt that while parents are in a frenzy trying to protect their children, they may be distracted from far more potent threats, such as lack of exercise, unhealthy diet, chronic stress, too little face-to-face interaction with friends, and lack of free time and access to nature, all of which are taking a horrible toll on children. We keep them indoors because we think it's safer, but dangers lurk in the house. Inactivity leads to obesity and diabetes, but other, less obvious conditions can be traced to overly sheltered childhood as well. In the past 5 decades, for example, the number of young adults in the United States and Europe with myopia has doubled, from about a quarter to half. Some researchers are predicting that by 2020, 1/3 of the world's population could be diagnosed with the condition. Why? Partly because kids aren't getting enough sunlight in their retinas and are focusing almost entirely on things that are close by, both because they're spending so much of their time indoors. Our panicky need to protect kids from imaginary dangers may owe something to the notion that the welfare of children is solely the responsibility of the parent and not of the community, the extended family, or the child herself. Liedloff's description of the Yaquana's approach to parenting along the Orinoco River in the Venezuelan Amazon echoes that of most anthropologists who spend time among foragers. The notion of ownership of another person is absent among the Yaquana. The idea that this is my child or your child does not exist. Deciding what another person should do, no matter what his age, is outside the Yaquana vocabulary of behaviors. The growing anxiety around parenting in the United States may also be tied to economic inequality. Fabrizio Zilibotti and Matthias Depka are economists whose research on parenting is explained in their book, Love, Money, and Parenting: How Economics Explains the Way We Raise Our Kids. They found that, compared to a generation or two ago, the amount of time parents spend supervising their kids has risen dramatically, especially in countries where economic inequality has also been increasing. As Zilibotti explains, in a society that is very unequal, where there are lots of opportunities if one does well, and very negative outcomes if one is less successful, parents will be more worried that their children won't become high achievers in school. But if you go to a country where there is less inequality, parents may be less worried about that, not because they care less about their children, but because the negative outcomes aren't as bad. Other considerations, such as the children's happiness and individuality, can be sacrificed to the frenzy to succeed. Given the unrealistic expectations placed upon both parents and children, and the American tendency to see misalignments between our evolved nature and our current society as pathologies that can be addressed with pharmaceuticals, it shouldn't be surprising that we're drugging kids into lethargic submission. By high school, nearly 1 in 5 boys in the United States will have been diagnosed with ADHD, a disease that strikingly resembles normal juvenile primate behavior, a need for plentiful physical activity, skepticism of authority figures, an insatiable hunger to play. In 1997, the Centers for Disease Control estimated that around 3% of American schoolchildren had been diagnosed with ADHD. By 2013, the percentage had exploded to 11%, and an astonishing 15.1% for boys. And of those who've received the diagnosis, 2/3 are being given prescription drugs. According to the manufacturer's warnings, side effects can include sudden death in children with undiagnosed heart problems, bipolar conditions, aggressive behavior or hostility, psychotic symptoms, such as hearing voices and believing things that aren't true, manic symptoms, facial tics, sleep disorders, paranoia, and suicidal feelings. And yet, sales of ADHD drugs increased by 89% between 2008 and 2016, rising from $5.5 billion to an estimated $12 to $14 billion. We seem to have decided that it's too expensive or inconvenient to modify the environments our children learn in, so we're modifying their brain chemistry instead. The suspicion that a lot of kids are being drugged just for being kids is supported by a study published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, showing that boys born in December, thus, typically the youngest boys in their class, were 30% more likely to receive a diagnosis of ADHD than boys born in January. And these boys were 40% more likely to be given a prescription for meds. Their sickness appears to boil down to having been born in December instead of January. Developmental psychologist Peter Gray has written extensively about how foragers consider children deserving of respect. Hunter-gatherers' treatment of children is very much in line with their treatment of adults. They do not use power-assertive methods to control behavior. They believe that each person's needs are equally important, and they believe that each person, regardless of age, knows best what his or her needs are. Gray then links this individual autonomy to the ecological and economic context of the hunter-gatherer social world, noting that children are not dependent on any specific other individuals, but upon the band as a whole, and this greatly reduces the opportunity for any specific individuals, including their parents, to dominate them. Children are free to move into other huts, most commonly the huts of their grandparents or uncles and aunts, if they feel put upon by their parents. Training the desire for play out of children is a bit like teaching birds not to sing. It can probably be done, but why? Kids play because it teaches them how to live together. Gray has concluded that play is not only fundamental to the cognitive and physical development of children, but was also a foundation for hunter-gatherer social existence. Gray sees play and humor at the core of hunter-gatherer social structures and mores. They function to promote an egalitarian attitude, extensive sharing, and relative peacefulness, for which hunter-gatherers are justly famous and upon which they depend for survival. Play, in Gray's view, amounted to serious business in foraging communities in that it provided a foundation for modes of governance, religious beliefs and practices, approaches to productive work, and means of education. But increasingly, even the smallest children's lives are being oriented away from play and toward work. Daphna Basak, a researcher specializing in educational policy, found that in 1998, 30% of American teachers believed that children should learn to read while in kindergarten. By 2010, that figure had almost tripled to 80%. The absence of time to just hang out and play together is having serious consequences in how kids develop. They can do math in first grade, but they are not attuned to subtle social cues, says Dr. Ellen Littman, a clinical psychologist and co-author of Understanding Girls with ADHD. They are not developing the normal skills that come from interacting with play, including how to manage their emotions. Peter Gray agrees. Where do children learn to control their own lives? When adults aren't around to do it for you, he said. If you don't have the opportunity to experience life on your own, to deal with the stressors of life, to learn in this context of play where you're free to fail, the world is a scary place.